session number 28935, reel 4.
Prescribe at reel 4. Where did you do your deck landings, and what was the process? How many did you have to do to qualify?
The early deck landing work was done off the Orkneys and around Scapa Flow and so forth, as I recall. Also, I think in the Clyde. In fact, most of the training took place in the Clyde.
What does it feel like, obviously, the first time that you come to land on an aircraft carrier, having done your practice on
Certainly, your first feeling is one of slight apprehension, because the thing looks very small. And it is really only in the last few seconds that you realise that it's going to be big enough to take you. Until that moment, you've been in serious doubt about it. This is I'm talking about one's early feelings about it. And of course, I'm describing here landing on a deck, a steady deck, which is what you would get in the Clyde. As I've said, our training was in the Clyde. I think almost all the escort carrier people were trained in the Clyde, an excellent area with lots of sea room to carry out a sustained program of flying.
How many landings would you have to make, roughly, do you think?
I think 3, 4, something like that, just enough to familiarise oneself. You have to realise that one was under pressure, the squadron's under pressure, the service is under pressure, to produce men who can go and do a job of work which is urgently required. None of this take it easy, chaps. Perhaps another day. You've got to get on with it.
So, you did your torpedo training, you did your
deck landing training.
Are you then ready to be operated?
No. Then, in my case, I went down to St. Medin, where they were training telegraphist air gunners in air gunnery. And my job was to fly these blokes in the aircraft we had, which included, interestingly enough, the Shark, a horrible machine. Another biplane, but the air gunner could go up in that with his gun and pop away at a towed target. This was, that was it. Vaguely,
did that get you used though, to having somebody else in the aircraft with you?
Yes,
that actually.
Now you mention it, it was the first. Experience of being responsible for somebody else. Vitally important. It was the first introduction to the telegraphist air gunner's role, one which incidentally is not as appreciated as I think it ought to be. So that was this at St. Mary. I was a midshipman there, green as grass, of course.
You mentioned the Shark was a horrible aircraft.
Yes.
What was the reasoning behind that? Obviously,
it was very unwieldy. At least I thought. But remember that those are the opinions of a rookie, a novice. A very experienced pilot would have said, oh yes, the Shark's not bad, I can think of the such and such and such, such much worse. Excuse me a moment, can you? Yes, what do I remember of St. Mirren, apart from the flying? Yes, Edgar Lee, one of the five survivors of the Channel Dash. He and I used to sit in the control tower at night on duty. We did no flying at night, but we had to man the control tower because we were next to St. Evil, which was very active, Coast Command sending out its aircraft over the Atlantic. And I remember Edgar Lee saying that he would never fly behind a single engine again. He lost his confidence after the Channel Dash. That's an interesting episode in my recollections. liked the place, and it was from there that I went to help form the last of the Navy's, Royal Navy's Saltery Squadron. And I say the last of the Royal Navy because another squadron was formed later, but that was Dutch manned and became absorbed with 836 Squadron, the MAC ship lot. And in fact, the very last Saltery Squadron was 119 of the RAF flying in the Channel, and they had a couple of successes there.
What squadron did you form?
842 Squadron was its number, 842. It started with, as I recall, half a dozen swordfish, but we became a composite squadron, as had been other squadrons, composed of a fighter, either the Seafar or the Wildcat. The composite squadron's role was to work on anti-submarine work. The fighter, primarily for dealing with shadowers, but also, as appeared later, to join in the combined attack. But that's a separate item which I can talk about another time. So that was the squadron, these six or so aircraft, under the command of Charles Lamb of Taranto, which worried us a trifle because we were very green and he was a thruster. Good CO because he talked to all of us. Very important. He got to know us not as a lofty bloke but as a rather jolly chap, really.
You mentioned your role. Was there any specific training or working up that you had to do as the squadron was forming?
Yes, at the time, Charles Lamb wanted us apparently to go and attack E-boats in the Channel, which worried us a trifle, being new boys. But he only lasted about a month because he had suffered considerably in a French POW camp in North Africa under the Vichy French. And he showed signs of illness shortly after taking up duties with our squadron, and the medical people said you were going to go off on lecture tour instead. And that was the end of his squadron command. He never had, apart from us, he never did command a squadron. Went on to become flight deck officer, I think, of one of the fleet carriers. Founded the White Ensign Association as well. Of course, that brings in Belfast, doesn't it?
You said you were apprehensive about the prospect of attacking E-boats.
Yes.
What was the reasoning behind E-boats?
Sounded dangerous.
Were you aware, obviously, that they were heavily armed?
We weren't really aware of. All we knew was that Peter Scott was there in the Channel doing all sorts of things. Yes. Well, let's face it. We were absolutely grass green. We knew nothing. I was never one shouting, "Come on, let's find the enemy. Let's go and do." No, thank you very much. He can stay away, as far as I'm concerned, so long as he doesn't cause us problems.
So you were working up. What type of exercises were you doing?
A lot of formation flying. This was at Lyon-Saint. Yes, doing a lot of formation flying and navigation exercises. I recall one formation flight. It was on a fine day, slightly misty, and bearing in mind that Lee is near Southampton and that Southampton was protected by balloons, our flight leader, who is still alive and living in southeast England, was like myself, very new, very inexperienced, which is not a reflection on this flight. But I can tell you that having flown in the neighbourhood of Southampton in Vic and returned and then been asked to inspect the flight leader's aircraft, you'll understand that it really wasn't his fault. You do not see a balloon cable when you hit it, but there was evidence of having struck a balloon cable slap bang on the spinner, and 100 foot of cable wrapped down behind it. And we didn't know anything about it until after we'd landed, and I was flying in a number three position on the port hand.
Sounds like the swordfishes are very rugged.
Yeah, thank you. You're coming to the point that I want to make. An extremely rugged aircraft. Have you considered John Willem's account of wrapping himself into a balloon cable over Taranto? Have you? Yes. A very rugged machine.
So could it take a lot of punishment from various things?
Oh, yes. I don't know what it is like to have two pots shot away, but I have heard of this happening, and the machine keeping going. Yes, certainly a very rugged machine. This particular chap I'm talking about, who led this flight too close to the Southampton balloon barrage, once, when he was, not for the first time, disobeying orders and attacking a U-boat, was carrying depth charges on the fire, came back and found an unexploded 20 millimeter shell in his lower main plane. That is an example. You see, it doesn't give much resistance to shells and things like that, so it's very handy stuff to have around you.
Any other incidents that occurred during the working up period that spring to mind?
Yes, I suppose. Not working up at Lee, but working up later on when moving to Scotland and getting to know our carrier, which was an escort carrier. Now, you should know probably that, for example, with the small ships, they were inspected by a man, I believe, called Commander Stevenson, or Admiral, I'm not sure which, but he was known as the Terror of Tobermory, I think, which was his head base. And he was, apparently, a very terrifying man, full of tricks. One occasion he came over the side, took off his, he must have been an admiral, he took off his brass hat. Well, commander's a brass hat too, never mind. Threw it on the deck and said, "That's a fire, put it out." Whereupon went on the side party, kicked it over the side. Well, the Fleet Air Arm had a similar sort of gentleman. He was the architect of Taranto, called Admiral St. John Lumley Lister. And he came out to us when we'd completed our working up to inspect us. And having done his inspection, a very junior officer was detailed off to fly him ashore to Macrahanish, and that was me. So he did his usual thing, came out on the flight deck wearing his great coat and just a Mae West, and climbed in the back, slapped me on the shoulder, and away I went, tootling down the flight deck until I got abreast the bridge, which is pretty far forward down the flight deck. And the engine decided that it didn't like what it was doing. I don't know quite what it got up to then, but it wasn't behaving itself at all, and certainly wasn't going to take us off the carrier. But I couldn't see anything useful to be done at that stage. There wasn't room left to put on the brakes. In fact, nothing. So I sat down. And actually, getting to the very last foot or two of the flight deck, the engine commenced working again. And I dived over the bars, skillfully, may I say, keeping the aircraft out of the water, though it kept on trying to go into it, eventually climbing away, and we headed off to Macrahanish, where I landed, taxied up next to the control tower, sat at attention, looking straight ahead of me, because I ought to explain that I had not said one word to the admiral in the back, nor had there been a sound from the back. So you can understand that I was sitting at attention there by the control tower, waiting for the gentleman to get out and disappear. But he didn't do that until he'd come round by the leant out of the back cockpit, peered into my face for a long time, and then disappeared again, not uttering a sound. And the last I saw of him was disappearing towards the control tower. And I've often wondered since then, did he think that I had been playing games with him and Crow's throttled deliberately to put the frighteners up him? So you asked me, any special things? That is it. I nearly put the architect of Taranto in the water.
Your carrier, what was your carrier that you were working on?
The carrier was an American-built escort carrier. Trying to remember the build of the great American shipbuilder's name, Kaiser, that's right, Kaiser built. 10,000 tonners, welded steel, about 4 weeks from laying the keel to launching sideways into water. That's the way the Americans worked. 4 weeks for the hull to be in the water and taken away for completion. That completion period would take several months. But this was a welded metal shell which was to become a floating gasoline tank. Approximately 30,000 tons, gallons of aviation gasoline. I may say I've been talking about working up in the Clyde. At the time that my squadron had started at Leon Solent, which was in March of 42, we heard that one of these ships had blown up in the Clyde, and that was the Dasher, which didn't encourage one particularly. However, this was they were good ships, these American-built escort carriers. They had Oregon pine flight decks. Now, a wooden flight deck is a useful thing to have. It is less prone to slip, and in the Arctic we found that that was very useful because of the ice that can be built up. There's no wood within the ship itself, only on the flight deck. I say no wood, not that I knew of. Everything was designed to prevent fire. One of the drawbacks was that if you were in the after section of the ship and somebody dropped a spanner on the forward end of the ship, you could probably hear it. They 17 knots approximately. The flight deck was just under 500 feet. The flight deck itself was just about 80 feet across. And useful in the Arctic, our particular escort carrier had transverse running steam vents set in intervals right up the flight deck. And they're very useful because when you get a build-up of ice and snow, of course, you want to do something about it and clear it. The trouble with the British flight deck and the metal flight deck was that in that climate, steam has to come out of a hose, and otherwise all you've got is brooms and scrapers. And undoubtedly, in fact, we had this experience in the Arctic, that where we were in company with a British-built metal flight deck fella, he had to stop work because he couldn't clear his deck fast enough. We could, which meant that we weren't trying to plow off the flight deck. You can imagine, you've got small diameter rubber tires on the saltfish. Trying to plow through 6 inches of snow is slowing you down, and you're carrying quite a weight. You're trying to go off at full load.
With the saltfish, what kind of armaments would you be carrying with it?
You've got a wide choice. Apart from the torpedo, you can carry 250-pound depth charges, four of them, or eight rocket projectiles. Now, they carry 60-pound semi-arm-piercing warheads, or mines. I have never carried mines. Some aircraft, I believe, carried a mix of depth charge and a rocket, but how they did it, I don't know. I think that I have only read this and that the author was mistaken. I have personally never come across a mix of that kind, because whereas you can carry your depth charges on the conventional lower main plane of the Swordfish canvas, for rocket work, the underside of the lower main plane has to be metalled, because you've got a great swoosh coming out of those rockets. Wonderful things, incidentally. It's great platform. This is one of the things about the Swordfish. It was a wonderful platform for launching rockets.
Operationally, where were you first escorted?
Our first job was the occupation of the Azores. The purpose of that was to help close the Atlantic gap. We already had Iceland under our control for Coast Command to use to approach the gap from the north, but also needed to be done from the south. And furthermore, we were starting to run convoys into the Mediterranean from the States. So that part of the world had to be covered. And we were given the job of occupying it. It sounds very martial, etc., but it wasn't. It was a very peaceful affair indeed. These few old biplanes landed at Largens Airfield, where we were met by sundry local peasants looking curious, and that's about all. And it was a wonderful, peaceful event altogether. And a few weeks after that, the RAF came and relieved us and carried on from there. But we were the ones who landed originally. And it's often struck me since this. You may recall that when Wellington finally departed Portugal to chase the French back over the Pyrenees, he turned around on his horse and said something like, "Farewell, Portugal, I shall not see you again," or something like that. That was our last military presence, until 842 Squadron Walrus landed at Largens Airfield so many years later. The return of the British.
So a very peaceful occupation.
It was a very peaceful occupation. All we did from there was fly patrols. There were a lot of submarines around. But as you must have learned in your inquiries, the Swordfish only had to be seen by a submarine to make that submarine go down. We were doing our job. If we were seen, the boat stayed down.
Can you describe to me how you conduct a patrol, an anti-submarine patrol?
I can, but I think at the moment I'd like to call them. Well, now, the anti-submarine patrol, a tedious but necessary job, in fact, the essential job, lasting about 2.5 hours at 3,000 feet in varying patterns, bearing reptiles' names like member, cobra, alligator, and so forth, all indicating the sort of range one should be at, and the pattern to be followed. The object was, first and foremost, to be seen by the U-boats. If they saw you, and that made them stay submerged, your work was virtually complete. My personal recollection of spending hour after hour after hour in an open cockpit, day or night, is that there was one constant fear in one's head, which can be explained by the fact that one was listening to the engine all the time. One was out of sight of the ship, one was out of range of land, and if the engine failed, and it was just one engine, you were done for. You were not allowed to have radio contact with the ship except in an emergency. Well, never fortunately having been in that emergency, I don't know what one would have done, but in practice RT silence was required. So that was the great fear about this sort of work, in my mind, and I think in probably in everybody's. The other one, of course, was the return to the flight deck, which could be unpleasant because the North Atlantic is not a mill pond. It is bears little resemblance to the Irish Sea or the Clyde, or even the English Channel or the North Sea. You have the swell that has come up from the South Atlantic, creating very disturbed sea conditions. The Bay of Biscay is an excellent example. Talking about the landing on, one should consider the state of mind of a pilot after a couple of hours in an exposed cockpit, particularly in the Arctic. His state of mind, the cold, the strain of staring at the water. And why was one staring? Because one was trying to detect the feather from a submarine's periscope. One has been looking at broken water for 2.5 hours. Is that bit of broken water in fact caused by a periscope, or is it just another breaking wave? This sort of work creates considerable fatigue. You need your wits about you when you return to a ship where one moment the bows are buried in a wave and the screw is aft is out of the water. The next moment the stern is nearly buried in the water and the bows are sticking way up. On top of that, it is tending to corkscrew, and you've got to get on to that. In the Arctic, we, and I think most squadrons, were provided with a little blue pill, which was, as one knows today, benzedrine. And that was taken shortly before landing on to concentrate the mind. And it seemed to work. So that's about all I can say about the patrol, except to repeat that if one was seen by the enemy and he decided to stay down, you had achieved your object.